I have about 30 view graphs. Some of them I probably will just flash them and move along, and some of them I must spend a little time. This is an outdated view graph. The only reason I'm showing this is it shows my email address. If anyone is interested in making a note of it, that is vemuri1, V-E-M-U-R-I-1, @llnl.gov. That stands for the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. We are located right next door to the laboratory, so they allow us to use their email address. That's why you do not see ucdavis.edu. Okay. The material I'm going to present is relatively elementary. I do know there are two or three people, at least in this room, who are probably doing much more advanced work than what I'm going to present. But the whole idea is to introduce the topic, and hopefully we will have more converts into the field. So I'm essentially going to talk about what are genetic algorithms, where they're useful, and I'm going to give a running example. And this running example, in my opinion, is a very useful example. You can use this example to a variety of applications, and you can go to a lot of deeper and theoretical concepts and so forth. If I stand here, is this bothering you? Okay. And then I will mention a couple of more realistic examples, which are almost impossible to talk about in a one-hour lecture. So, what are genetic algorithms? Basically, what we are talking about are algorithms that imitate biological evolution, mathematical methods that imitate biological evolution. By and large, these are nothing but search and optimization methods. So if you know of one method that has some kind of search and optimization, this is one more method. And these are primarily very useful in rugged search spaces rather than smooth areas. If you have a smooth search space, probably a calculus method is a lot better than a genetic algorithm. And also they are very good for multimodal environments. Multimodal in the sense you have several peaks and valleys in the same area, and you would like to be able to locate the heights and locations of each and every one of them. And they are kind of robust in the sense they are problem independent. Most of the genetic algorithm really has nothing to do with the problem you are solving. Once you understand the basic ideas, the interface between the algorithm and the problem is going to happen at only two or three places. Once you understand that, the whole problem is solved. So they are fairly generic in that sense. What I'm going to do is present some main ideas, something like this. The solutions of a genetic algorithm, when I talk about solutions, essentially I'm using the word chromosome. So as long as you hear the word chromosome, that is synonymous with a solution. In normal mathematical methods, you start with one solution and you keep improving that solution. In genetic algorithms, you start with a population of solutions, 10, 100, 200, something like this. And you evaluate the fitness of each and every one of those solutions. The most fit solutions are the ones that are the solution to our problem. And in evaluating the fitness of these solutions and improving the quality of the solutions, I do what is called a selection. And when I do the selection, I'm looking for desirable traits. You can see the imagery of the language is similar to the one that you find in Darwin's theory of evolution. You'll see a lot of those words, but you don't have to know anything about biology or genetics to do this. And then you made two solutions using an operation called crossover to get new solutions. And the optimization technology, we call this exploitation. That means if I know already two solutions, I know something about them. I want to exploit that knowledge to create a new solution. And you sometimes mutate a solution, then I call that exploration. When I'm mutating, I'm entirely going into a new domain, and that is exploration to see other opportunities. I keep doing this kind of a process until I get convergence. That is basically the central idea of a genetic algorithm. And these are some of the basic characteristics. We know many of the genetic algorithms are good really at solving hard problems. I will try to define what is meant by hard a little later on, but right now let's leave it as an intuitive idea. And genetic algorithms are very easy to interface with existing models. Let us suppose I have a fairly complicated finite element model for this flow of water in an underground formation. And let us suppose I want to do some optimization on trying to locate the position of pumping wells and recharge wells so that I can do some pumping and recharging of the aquifer. It's relatively easy to take that such huge code and try to interface this with an existing generic algorithm. And similarly, if you have a telescope design and you have a fairly large code to do that, you want to apply a new idea, you can do this. The same idea is expressed by this. And as I said, it really needs very little domain knowledge. You don't have to be an expert in optimization of water resource systems or an expert in telescope design to truly apply a genetic algorithms. As long as you have the basic understanding, you can go ahead and do it. I'm going to illustrate the central idea of the genetic algorithm with a simple example. Let us suppose I have a fairly convoluted search space, and I'm trying to locate the position of the maximum, or perhaps position of the tallest peak and the next tallest peak system. What I normally do is randomly select a bunch of points on the x-axis, and the solutions are indicated by those dots there. After the application of genetic algorithm for 5 generations, you will know what I mean by generation in a second, you can see these 2 points moved a little higher. You have to just eyeball this. These 2 points moved a little higher, and these 2 climbed up a little higher, and these 2 climbed up a little higher. If I run this for 5 more generations or 10 more generations, I would see a bunch of points bunching up here and some of the points bunching up here, which tells me that I'm able to find both those peaks. That is roughly the way a genetic algorithm works. To illustrate this, we actually applied this to a much complicated problem than this simple thing. This is what is called a test function. This was artificially created function with a number of peaks located in a regular pattern with different heights. And you see these dark dots there are the solutions of the genetic algorithm. We randomly took at one shot somewhere in the middle of the computation. So you can see there are lots of dots bunched up at the peaks. Some of them, of course, are overshot, like there is a overshot mark here, overshot mark. But majority of these dots bunched up at the things, and these things are still trying to find their way either to climb one of these peaks or disappear from the scene. One of those things could happen. And we applied one of the genetic algorithms to solve this problem as a test problem, and it worked well. So now, you got a bird's eye view of what a genetic algorithm is as a scientific American kind of a thing. Now let's get into the nitty-gritty. Normally, the whole process of applying the genetic algorithm goes through this thing. I start with a population of chromosomes. Chromosome is nothing but a solution. So I start with a population of solutions. I use this population of solutions as parents and go through a process called reproduction. And as a result of this, we get children or offspring solutions. That means these children have some traits that are similar to the parents and probably some new traits that they acquired due to mutations or whatever. And then what I do is, you know, for the sake of drawing the picture, I have to show the mutation as if the mutation is applied after the child is born. But in reality, the mutations usually take place while the child is still in the biological world. So this is nothing but a mutation. You take the mutant children and you evaluate those chromosomes. If these chromosomes are doing better than this, normally we hope our children are better than ourselves. So this is the positive thing. Then what we will do is we will take the children to be the next generation population and dump the old people and unproductive people and so forth. And you keep doing this. If you do it enough number of times, you will find the right solution. That is the basic philosophical idea behind this genetic algorithms. For most of our purposes, it is sufficient to know 3 mathematical operations to apply this. One is called selection. Selection essentially is an implementation of survival of the fittest concept. The second one is called crossover. This combines 2 individuals to generate new combinations of solutions. Most of the time you use 2 individuals to produce an offspring. I have seen people using 3 individuals, and sometimes I call these people, they belong to San Francisco's Haight-Ashbury district or someplace. Okay, but normally we have 2. And In a mutation, what we try to do is introduce new features that are not present in the parents. That is normally the function of biological mutation. So each of these things, I'm going to spend one view graph, the selection operator. We talked about three of them. During the selection process, I'm going to calculate the fitness of all the members of the population. If this is the population in this room, we are going to find out the fitness of each and every one of us to do something. It could be anything. And then we select those with better fitness scores. Maybe the top half of the class with better scores I'm selecting. And then use one of the many selection schemes. You know, this selection, as I say, there are at least 10 different ways of selecting. In the presentation, I'm going to use one particular one to make it easy. The one particular one is called the roulette wheel selection, also known as the fitness proportionate reproduction. It is very simple. It simply says the higher the fitness of an individual, the more chances that individual gets to reproduce. It's almost like in the wild kingdom. Some animals, if they are very strong, they will beat the competing species so that they can have their genes propagated through the offspring. That is essentially what we do. There are other methods like tournament selection, which is very familiar to all of us who watch games like tennis and so forth. But I'm going to spend most of the time on fitness proportionate reproduction kind of a method. So much for selection. Now I'm going to spend 1 second on this crossover operation to illustrate what we mean. Let us suppose I have two parents in my population. I want to represent each of these parents by this binary string and by this binary string. I haven't really told you what the binary string is, but it will come in a second. But let us pretend this parent is coded by that string, this parent is coded by that string. Then one way of producing children is randomly pick a point. Let us suppose I randomly picked a point here and another point. Pick the point there, and then these underlined pieces are exchanged so that one child gets 100, 001, and then 00. The other child gets the image of that. That is called crossover. Once again, there are many ways of doing this crossover. This is simply called a two-point crossover because I cut it here and here to exchange pieces. As you gain more and more exposure, you will see more and more sophisticated ways of crossovers. A mutation is very simple. Assuming, once again, this is a coded representation of this parent, and if I randomly choose one of these bits and change it, then the child is this one. That's one way of thinking of mutation. You don't even have to call this a parent. You can say this is a child before the mutation is applied. This is the child after the mutation is applied. In whatever. So essentially, these are the three basic operations that we do. And for the next 10-15 minutes, I'm going to walk you through an example, running example. And this example looks terribly simple, but it is very informative. And the more sophisticated techniques you want to apply, you are welcome to apply them. I will try to keep it at a relatively simple operation. What I have is somebody like a McDonald's, Burger King, or one of these food chains. That's what I call a franchisor. He wants to start a restaurant. And because we are so close to the French influence here, I thought we will try to see, typically in my view, a French restaurant is one that is sophisticated and fancy, with expensive and so forth. A regular hamburger joint is one that is cheap. You go with blue jeans there, and in a French restaurant, you have to wear a tie and all those things. So essentially, that is the context I have when I built this thing. To make the problem simple, as a restauranter, let us suppose I'm interested in building the restaurant. I wanted to keep my choices to a very small number, only because I want to able to show this to you on the screen here. So these are the only choices I have. Am I going to build an affordable joint or a fancy restaurant? That's one choice. Am I going to serve something like hot dogs, or I'm assuming crepes are fancy? Simply, I have this mental block in my mind. Anything French is fancy. So crepes is the... Or you want to serve something like a soft drink or maybe wine. You know, In this affordable fancy, you can assume in the fancy restaurant, the waiter will come with a little white towel on his head. Usually you don't have waitresses in fancy restaurants, only waiters. And quite often they speak in French. They show you a menu in French and all those things. That is affordable. That is fancy. Affordable is when you just go to a McDonald's joint. That is the problem we want to solve. The problem is, how do I know what choice I have to make between these three things so that I can make some profit out of this? Okay? The first thing I do for any problem like this is what is called encoding the problem. And in this problem, it is very simple. What I'm going to do, I'm going to define a chromosome that is 3 bits long, and I will encode them as follows. If bit 3 is 0, that means I have chosen the affordable restaurant. If bit 3 is 1, I have chosen the fancy restaurant. Similarly, bit 2, hot dogs and crepes for 0 and 1, soft drinks and wine for... So if all 3 are 1s, you get a fancy restaurant with wine, crepes and a fancy place. If all 3 are 0s, you get a very cheap joint. And you can have all combinations. Okay, this is the problem I want to solve using a genetic algorithm. This is so simple that you can remember the coding easily in your mind. And so, how do I do it? First of all, I have to define what is the fitness of my problem. Because I'm in the business of making money, the fitness is one that tells me how much profit I am making for whatever choice I'm making there. And it is not an easy thing to figure out. How much profit you make, it depends upon the cost of ingredients, cost of labor, cost of manpower, the location of the restaurant, the times at which it is open, all kinds of things. And it is so complicated, I may need a computer program to simulate, to find out how much profit I am making. But I cannot do all of that here, so I chose a very simple mechanism to figure out how much profit I am making. I simply said, the profit is nothing but the decimal value of the 3-bit sequence, so that I can do the problem. In reality, this could be a program that spit out the value of the profit, given the choices. You know, for this simple problem, I can exhaustively enumerate all the possibilities and find the correct answer. It is so simple. You know, I listed all the options here and all the options here. Because I'm a computer scientist, I know how to easily read these things and say this is $0, $1, $2, $3, like this, and $7. So we know the correct choice would be 111. You choose a fancy restaurant that serves crepes and wine. That is the one you make profit. Okay? Let us see how a genetic algorithm will solve this. And then you do not pay much attention to the mechanics of these numbers. We know the solution. What we have to pay attention to is, what are some of the things that the genetic algorithm is doing so that when you solve a real complicated problem, you can fall back on this? Let us pause for a minute and try to dismiss the exhaustive enumeration possibility, although I did it for this problem. In real life, this is almost impossible. Like, for example, if you are solving a 20-city traveling salesman problem, the classical example everybody gives, let us pretend on my computer it takes about an hour. It doesn't matter whether it is 1 hour or 1 minute, okay, for a 20-city problem. If you scale this up to 21-city problem, the same problem will take 20 hours. If you scale this up to 22 cities, it takes 20 days. And the same problem when I go to 25 cities, it takes about centuries, 6 centuries. Anybody can sit down and make this calculation. It shows there is a class of problems that whose behavior is so difficult because as you increase the size of the problem in a linear fashion, the complexity of the computation goes in an exponential fashion. And there is a general belief this is the kind of problems where genetic algorithms may play a useful role, not in solving the restaurant or problem. Okay? And so, we are beginning to see, now that we know in a real life it is much more difficult to do the exhaustive enumeration, we want to apply a genetic algorithm. And the way I'm going to do it is follows. I'm choosing 4 randomly selected strategies at 4 different outlets. We normally don't do this. If it is my money, I won't do it this way. But to illustrate the genetic algorithm, I'm saying, so I take 4 different locations, maybe one in Montreal, one in Quebec, one in Toronto, and one in Vancouver. I start 4 operations. I let them run for about a month or for a week or whatever it is. and see which of them is making a good profit. Let us suppose the one in Ottawa is making a good profit. I want to find out what is it I am doing in the Ottawa outlet that I am not doing in Toronto and Montreal and other places. That is the whole idea behind this kind of an experimentation. Observe the outlets, compare their performance, pick those that are doing well. For my case, I have to pick at least two restaurants that are doing well. Let us suppose the one in Montreal and one in Ottawa are doing better than the one in Toronto and Vancouver. Then I have to pick those two and say there is something in this thing, I don't know what it is. So I make those two individuals and ask them to produce children. Those children are nothing but new policies or new strategies that came out of the existing strategies, and I keep doing this again and again until I find a restaurant that is making the biggest profit. This thing, I'm going to work with this for about 5 to 10 minutes, maybe something like that. We'll keep seeing this. So I'm going to put here, the four outlets are here. Remember, we have a possibility of 8 possible solutions. That is the grand size of the population. I don't have the time and energy to do an exhaustive search on all of those 8. So I'm only going to choose 4. In reality, the ratio is much different. In reality, the size of the population can be 10 to the power of 20. Whereas the size I'm choosing here could be about 100. Then it makes some sense. With only 8 and 4, you may not see the effect. But anyway, these are the population I have chosen at random. And I evaluated the fitness of each and every one of them. Straightforward. 3, 1, 6, 2. Then I have to do some statistics on the solution that I got. What are the statistics? I found the total fitness to be 12. The worst fit individual is 1. The average fitness is 12 divided by 4, 3. The best individual is 6. If you have more, you can do more statistics. Standard deviations, you know, second moments, and all kinds of things to characterize the population. Okay? Then, next thing I do is to create a mating pool. Creation of the mating pool essentially means all the poor people are not allowed to reproduce. Only the better ones are allowed to reproduce. This may sound a little bit like eugenics or what Hitler tried to do, but this is the way genetic algorithms work. I don't have a choice. So what I did was, I said, okay, the best individual is 6, and the average individual is 3, so I'm going to give this individual twice as many chances to reproduce as the average individual. Okay? So I copied the average individual once here, and I copied the best individual twice here. There is no relation between where I put these things. I just copied them from top to bottom. And then, with small solutions, I cannot do much. I am left with one slot, and between the other two, this guy is twice as fit as this. So I said, okay, I will give you a chance, and I dropped this fellow completely from consideration. You can do this in a lot more sophisticated way if you have a bigger size population so that things can be a lot more accurate. So that is what is called the mating pool. So as you can see, by itself, the mating pool is already improved. The statistics are already improved. If you look here once again, the fitness, the total fitness of this mating pool is higher than the original fitness of this population. The worst candidate has improved from 1 to 2. The average candidate has improved from 3 to 4.25. The best hasn't improved anything. But remember, I haven't done anything yet. I simply selected the better group of people. Then I'm going to do the actual crossover or recombination or ask them to produce children, whatever you want to call it. So I have 4 candidates here. In order to produce children, I have to pay them into twos. So I randomly pick any two of them. Let us say I pick these two at random and say these two constitute one set of parents, these two constitute another set of parents. I mate them to produce children. How do I mate them? I take this chromosome and randomly, let us say randomly there, cut that chromosome and this chromosome at the same spot and exchange 010111, 111010. I take these two parents and randomly cut, because I'm doing it random, if I do it at the same place, it is not going to be random, so I'm going to do it here now. 110010, 110010. In program, you essentially use a random number. So it is quite possible I may set it at the same place. But for the sake of illustration. So these are the children of these people. Now let us see what are the statistics of the children. This is the 7. You know, when I add them, the total fitness of the entire population remained the same from here to here. The worst candidate remained the same. The average value remained the same. But the best candidate has increased from 6 to 7. There is some improvement. And in reality, you have to do this about 20 times, 30 times like this before you stop. Because this problem is so simple and I know the correct answer, I'm stopping it here. That is the correct answer. I got it in one step. It's not going to happen in reality. And also because I know the correct answer, I know that is the point to stop. In reality, you do not know what the correct answer. It is quite possible you see the correct answer but may not recognize it and comes and goes. But those are all practical problems. But the central idea of the genetic algorithm is all here. And as I said, you can do a lot of things with this kind of, depending on your math background, you can do whatever you feel like doing to make it exciting. Okay? Now, let us see what did the franchiser learn in this. He went through this experiment, right? We went with him. And the first thing is you have to memorize the table at the back of your mind. $3 is an estimate of the average fitness of the search space. You see how I changed my wording now? Before I simply said the $3 is the average value of the profit. But it is not the average value because I am working with a sample of 4 people out of a population of 8. So this sample is only giving me an estimate of the average that is supposed to reflect the population average. Okay? And second thing is, you know, again, as I'm just giving you ideas, 110, this is one of the individuals in our population, is 200% better than the estimated average. 010 is two-thirds as good as the estimated average. You see, one can sit here, depending on your statistical background, and play with whatever information I have to your heart's content until you get a true picture of the way the entire population is going to behave based on these 4 people. Okay? So, okay, we learned something, and I just showed that to kind of... So what do we do next? We learned something about the thing, and we studied the statistics and so on and so forth. The first thing is to say, let us keep on searching until I find a better solution. You know, here you have to pretend that 111, you do not know that is the correct solution. So you keep on, what is the problem with this? If you already got the best solution and you spend some more time and money to look for a better solution, that is down the drain. In our case, if I go any further, every time I'm going through one more set cycle, okay, knowing the 7 is already the best profit I can get and only 3 is the average profit I can get. 7 minus 3 is $4. On the average, I'm losing $4 every time I'm experimenting with a new strategy. Okay? And so that is the drawback. I'm trying to give you an illustration of this by saying if I use an exhaustive search, brute force method, to a real-life problem rather than to an artificially contrived problem, it's not unusual to find a chromosome with 90 bit positions. Very easily I can show you chromosomes that are about 90 bits long. With a chromosome with 3 bits, I had 2 to the power of 3 or 8 members in the population. With a chromosome of 90 bits, I have 2 to the power of 90 potential population size. If I want to exhaustively search the 2 to the power of 90, it takes enormous amount of time and I don't even think we can conceivably entertain that idea. Now coming to this idea, I already touched upon, but we will touch upon again. Greedy method. The exhaustive enumeration is you just close your eyes and do it. The second one is greedy method. The greedy method says, keep on searching until you find a better solution. But I already told you, every time you keep searching, you are investing time and money and effort and so forth to find a better solution. If you don't have a better solution, that is a waste. If there is a better solution, you will get some raise. But let us see, suppose you decided not to search anymore. Okay? at the very beginning, before I found that seven. The very first selection, I got six as the best profit. If I don't go any further, I am losing a potential profit of $7 and I'm settling for $6. That means on the average, I'm losing $1 by not searching. By searching, I'm losing $3 because I don't know whether there is a better solution or not. So in other words, whether you want to explore new territory or exploit the current answer is something very difficult to decide given that you do not know what the correct answer is. This is just an illustration to show for this little problem. How the dynamics of that thing work. Okay, I'm going to just summarize the restauranter problem for a second. Then we'll essentially what we did in this restauranter problem as a way of applying a genetic algorithm, we started with a random set of initial population, the four strategies that we used in the table. And I evaluated the fitness of each and every member of the population. Remember, this is a fairly time-consuming operation in a real-life problem. In that water resources problem I mentioned kind of in passing, where you have to solve a partial differential equation for two-phase flow using a finite element method with 10,000 grid points or something. Each run will cost me substantial amount of computer time and money. And if I have to do this for each and every option that I have in my strategy, it is going to cost me a lot. So it's a very expensive thing, but you evaluate that. And then you have a little loop here for generation 1 to maximum number of generations. The maximum number of generations is your choice. Typically, we put about 100 to 200 generations because in most of the experiences that we have, you normally end up getting a solution that you can live with within 200 generations. Okay. And within each generation, you go through a selection step, which involves nothing but creating a mating pool. You go through a reproduction step or mating step, which involves crossing over and possibly mutation. You don't have to do both of them all the time. Sometimes you do, sometimes you skip that. But without crossover, suppose I just have mutation, it almost degenerates to a random walk. Okay. And replacement step. That means in the restauranter example, what I did was I replaced the population, that four people or four strategies, entirely by the children because they produced four children. So the four children occupied the slots and all the four parents were driven out. That is one way of doing the replacement. Or if you rather have some kind of continuity, like the way our human society works, we have both parents and children together at the same time, and you use some other criterion to delete people who are not doing a good job. Okay. So essentially, that is the structure of a genetic algorithm, and anything and everything you do is nothing but making things a little bit more realistic and so forth. By the way, I left a copy of these view graphs here, and you will be having a library, and assuming this videotape comes right, you can probably use those tapes along with that. The next few minutes, I want to spend a little time on some of the other examples that one might be able to do. The most famous example, in my view, is using genetic algorithms to automatically generate computer programs. The point here is we all know writing a computer program is very error-prone, labor-intensive, and so on and so forth. We have software. You bring a software engineer, he will tell you all the problems with current techniques of software development. How nice it would be if we can produce a program automatically that will do. Remember, people have been trying for almost 50 years to automate the process of programming. They have not succeeded. So I'm not telling that this is the answer, but I'm simply showing a way that Professor Koza at Stanford attempted to address this problem, and I will give you a little more information. And the rest of the examples to give you the diversity of topics to which this problem has been applied. Prisoner's Dilemma is very well-known game theoretic kind of a problem. I do not wish to go into the details of it, but a fellow by name Axelrod solved this problem almost 15, 10 years ago. That means soon after genetic algorithms started appearing on the horizon with Holland's original work, he attempted to implement that so that, you know, it's an interesting problem for anybody to study. I suggest those of you who are interested should look at that. Designing a sorting network using diploid chromosomes. The main reason I put it here is for two reasons. The problem of sorting a list of 16 numbers, I'm not talking about tons and thousands of numbers, I'm not talking about order n log n and things like that. A simple problem of sorting 16 numbers by doing the minimum number of interchanges. For some reason, in the 1960s, it caught the attention of some of the greatest computer scientists, including people like Knuth. Okay, they were trying to figure out, can we prove using some theoretical methods, or can we establish a bound on the minimum number of operations you have to do to sort a list of 16 numbers. They were never able to solve it perfectly, but this, there was a lively debate for almost a decade on various ways of doing it. And in that context, this fellow, Hillis, the same guy who invented the connection machine, he wanted to solve that problem on his connection machine, sorting a number of 16 numbers. And the main interesting thing he did was he introduced what is called a diploid chromosome. Diploid chromosome is the way our chromosomes are. You know, all of you know, human chromosomes comes, 23 chromosomes are there, but they came in 23 pairs. That means there are really two copies of each chromosome. That is called a diploid chromosome. And the example we did for the restauranter problem is a haploid chromosome, only one strand. This is a double strand. So those of you who are interested to know how can we use a diploid chromosome, you should look at Hillis's work to get some idea. And Koza, the same guy here, he used this idea of genetic programming to make a prediction of the secondary structure of what is called protein molecules. Well, really, he did not make a prediction of the secondary structure itself. He asked a question. Is a segment of this molecule, a protein molecule, a transmembrane segment or not? Yes or no? So it's not same as telling, given a protein molecule, tell me what is the structure. He did not solve that. He simply took a protein molecule and asked the question, is this sequence of amino acids constitute a transmembrane segment? And to answer that question, he produced a program. I will show you a segment of that program in a minute. Then myself and my graduate student, this is a fellow who just recently graduated, we applied genetic algorithms to what is called a multi-objective optimization. This is the one I was referring to, cleaning the polluted aquifer. Because there you have several objectives you have to meet, and we tried to see how to do that. And another thing we did is, how do you do what is called a DNA fragment assembly? This is a part of the Human Genome Project. I won't go into the details again. Anyone interested, I will send you a copy of either Sedanio's dissertation or a couple of papers we wrote. The interesting thing there is, we are talking about DNA molecules, chromosomes, genes, but I'm also talking when I'm applying a genetic algorithm. My chromosome is not same as the chromosome that you find in a DNA. So I had a lot of difficulty writing the paper, trying to separate the real-life things and so forth. But those are some examples. So I'm going to spend a couple of minutes on genetic programming because this is interesting. Somehow it caught my fascination, although I haven't done anything in this. Essentially, what Koza did, and there are other people who contributed to genetic programming. The reason why I keep saying Koza is because he works at Stanford. It's only 30 miles from where I live. I go often to meet his students and attend meetings and so forth. So I that is the main reason I know him fairly well. So think of each solution in the genetic algorithm that I'm talking about. Now, remember, population of solutions. Each of the solutions is now a computer program. In other words, I have a population of computer programs. Just like our population of individuals are randomly selected, right? In our restauranter problem, I've chose four people randomly, or four solutions randomly. So I have to choose a set of computer programs randomly. Hopefully they will compile and run. You see, these programs are created randomly. It's not somebody like, I ask 10 graduate students to write 10 programs and give them to me. They're created randomly. And then what I do, I run each of these programs to determine how well it solves the problem at hand, whatever problem you have in your hand. Like, let us suppose I want to write a program to generate random numbers. That's the problem. Okay, then what I do is somehow create a bunch of programs randomly, run each of them, and see the output. Is the output produced random numbers or not? It's almost like saying, why don't we bring a bunch of monkeys into the room, give them each a typewriter, ask each of them to type, and see maybe one of them is typing Hamlet. That is the same thing, okay? And so then you perform crossover and mutation on these programs to generate offspring programs. And after a few generations, you have a correct computer program. Actually, Professor Koza wrote a book that is about this thick, which is nothing but case histories of programs that he has run by doing this kind of thing. And to give you an illustration, I'm going to illustrate this with a very simple example. The first thing you have to do is to remember any computer program can be arranged as a tree structure like this. It's not, any computer scientist knows this. This is almost like first grade kind of thing for computer science people. For example, if I have an algebraic expression like this, 234z plus x minus 0.789, I can simply organize this. This plus goes there. 234 times z become the two leaves of this tree, and x minus 0.789 becomes this, and that whole tree is an expression for that thing. And let us suppose, instead of using linear chromosomes, I'm going to say, in this problem, that is a chromosome. Okay? Parent 2 describes another structure, and that is the chromosome for that. Once I have two parents, I have to define what is called a crossover. And you have to be careful, you know, depending on the problem, where you cut and paste may or may not make sense. So we have to be careful. So what I'm going to do is to, I'm going to cut this piece like this, and this piece like that, including the plus sign and everything that goes below it. And those pieces are shown here. That essentially I'm saying I'm cutting here, and I'm cutting here. And exchange those pieces so that the first child gets that piece attached here and this piece attached for this child. So now these two are two different expressions. This is an example of a crossover and a mutation of a computer program. So starting with this kind of a vision, of course, the next thing he did was, remember, Stanford is a place with steeping with artificial intelligence people from good old days. So they are Lisp creatures. So it's very easy for people to convert these expressions into Lisp expressions. Very easy. So they wrote these expressions as Lisp expressions, and they started playing around to see how the thing goes. And they used this idea, as I said, that whole book is full of examples of problems, but some of them are more interesting to talk about. So I thought I will show this. This is not my work. This is Professor Koza's work. He took this bacteria rhodopsin, some kind of a protein. Those of you with a biology background probably know. I think this is light-sensitive protein of some kind. And it is fairly well-studied thing. So what he wanted to do is locate the transmembrane segments of that protein. I won't go into the details and torture you with all the things. But, we will just ignore all these things. To identify a segment of that protein molecule that are within the cell membrane. So what he did was he applied this idea of random generated programs, and each of the program segments is nothing but a Lisp program. And after doing it, as I said, his book has given about 100 pages of description of what he has done to do this. I'm just showing the final answer. The final answer looks like this. That means this is the one that gave the best fitness. So you have to imagine how many hours he spent staring at things like this, trying to figure out what is right and what is wrong. But this is a Lisp expression, and he says, I'm happy. My computer produces the answer, and so on and so forth. There's a lot of debate going on whether this really is going to work or not, but for an academic context, it is really, to me, it is irrelevant whether there is a cost-benefit analysis for producing programs like that. But he did demonstrate that genetic algorithms can be used to do things like this. So essentially, what I have done today is this. Genetic algorithms are randomized optimization procedures. You could have used simulated annealing. You could have used hill climbing. You could have used many of the other methods. But the way this differs from most of the other methods, say simulated annealing, is you do not need any information about the derivatives or the function. You know, the function you're optimizing, it doesn't have to have derivatives existing and all those things. And they are easy to learn and implement. As I said, I jumped on this genetic algorithm thing only about a couple of years ago when my student started asking me to supervise his thesis. And it's very easy to learn. It really doesn't take too much mathematical background and so on and so forth. And you can apply them to a variety of problems. I haven't seen really any restriction. The only thing that you have to really worry about is it a hard enough problem for me to apply a genetic algorithm, or is there a convenient and cheaper way of doing it by some other method? Okay. And what I did not mention at all is genetic algorithms can be combined with neural nets. The reason I put it there is I spent a lot of my life doing work in neural nets. So it's interesting for me to see any new tricks this old dog is learning can be applied to some of the old tricks I have known. And it's interesting that you can take the training of a neural net, you take all the weights, and you consider that as a kind of a chromosome, and you keep on developing it until you get a chromosome that corresponds to the correct set of weights. Sometimes you may not know what is the learning rule in a neural net. You can use a genetic algorithm to find out what is the correct learning rule. Sometimes you may not know the architecture of a neural net. You can use a genetic algorithm to learn that. Things like this. And finally, I talked very briefly about Koza's work on how genetic algorithms can be used to produce correct computer programs. That is his world. He wants to make sure everybody understands that his program is correct, it is working, and it is producing the correct answer, and so on and so forth. Because all of us write programs. The programs I write, they never work. So I do admit that it is. So for those of you who are interested in exploring further, I just have a few sample problems. No, this is by no means, this is about 3 years old ViewGraph. Now we have tons of books in the market, but Holland is the grand old father of genetic algorithms. And so anybody who wants to look at his original work, Adaptation in Natural and Artificial Systems, he started doing this in 75 for almost 10 years. Not much attention was paid to that. And then starting in 1985, we started getting these proceedings at the International Conference on Genetic Algorithms. It happens every 2 years. This year, in July, it is taking place in East Lansing, Michigan. And then we have genetic algorithms and simulated annealing, because there is a lot of resemblance between genetic algorithms and simulated annealing. So those of you interested in this. This is another standard book, useful textbook. Goldberg is one of the big fellows, you know, following, I think he's a student of Holland. Okay. And he made a good name for himself, and he wrote a book that I used myself as a textbook. It is good and so forth. And these are the two books by Koza. One is called GP2. This is simply GP without a Roman numeral. But both of them are nothing but just a bunch of examples of what he did to make the genetic programming idea work. So that's all I have. I'll be happy to answer questions. Any comments?